turning astray of the path that was left long ago. All we leave behind, time after time, is a legacy with nothing to show. Now our country is lost, and it's not without cost, for there's many who struggle every day. And I think that it's time we start crying for our nation and bow our heads and pray. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death?
Hey everyone, this is Steve Donahue with the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. Today's episode is a message from Luke chapter 9, dealing with the feeding of the 5,000, where Jesus was able to multiply the bread and the fish to be able to feed over 5,000 people in the crowd on the Sea of Galilee or near the Sea of Galilee. It's a great message to build our faith and to identify Jesus as certainly the Messiah, the one who's able to provide for our various needs, the satisfaction that he provides in us, as well as an opportunity for us to be reminded of the great relationship that we have with the Messiah and all that he does for us. And so stay tuned for that. It's a great way to build your legacy spiritually. And I will be going out of town here, just to kind of give you a heads up, going out of town this next week. And so I will not be in the pulpit. And so the next message that you will hear, hopefully, will be a message about my trip to Ireland, which I'm going to be taking here with my family. And so I look forward to that. And I appreciate those of you who are supporting the show. There's all kinds of ways that you can do that. And you can find out all those ways by either clicking on the link in the show notes or going to the website and clicking on all the various banners and the different tabs that identify that as ways to support the show. Appreciate that again. And without further ado, here is Luke chapter 9.
We're going to be in Luke 9, as I mentioned earlier, Luke 9 chapter 9, verse 10 and through verse 17. So if you're not there already and you'd like to turn there, you can do that. While you're doing there, let me say, just about everybody likes to eat. You can probably say amen to that, right? In fact, some of the best fellowship that we have in church revolves around food, doesn't it? In fact, we were just talking about having our Easter celebration and having some breakfast afterwards. And you know, you can always tell when you're in a country church because the food is always so good. And so, you know, we always love to eat. It reminds me of the old Jewish proverb that says that people really aren't friends until they've eaten a pound of salt together. And the idea is not that we're just supposed to consume a bunch of salt. The idea is that you have a lot of meals together, so much so that as those, you spend all that time together eating, you develop a friendship and you develop a relationship there. And so, you know, eating is something very, very important. In fact, if you were to come to our house, I've got children now to the age where they all like to eat, especially my older boys. I can't seem to ever, poor Joanna, she can't ever seem to keep them fed. They're always wanting more food. And I think probably the biggest refrain in our house is, I'm starving. We hear that all the time, right? Well, can you imagine having to cook for 5,000 people or more? I mean, I don't know how many of y'all have ever cooked big meals. I mean, I know homecoming and stuff, we work on trying to get a good collection of food together, and you know, there might be 50 people, 100 people here or whatever. Can you imagine 5,000, a group of 5,000, and trying to make the organization necessary to be able to produce the food for that? That's incredible. And that's a serious problem when you have 5,000 people or more hungry. In fact, riots have been caused because of the hunger of large people like that in foreign countries. We know about that in Egypt this last year. And so it's not surprising that we come to this situation in Luke's gospel where there is a real problem with a group of people that are hungry. They get to the end of the day and they haven't had food and they don't have food. And Jesus identifies a real problem. And so based upon this situation, we are going to be able to draw some implications from it. But first, let's go ahead and look at the situation. The context of it is that we've already looked at five passages in the early life of Jesus, and then we looked at five passages dealing with the teachings of Jesus, and now we're starting a section dealing with five miracles of Jesus, and this is one of those. This is interesting, but it's the only miracle that occurs in all four of the Gospels, or recorded in all four of the Gospels. So certainly it is an important one. It took place in the spring of AD 29, near the Passover time by the Sea of Galilee. In fact, it was that they were traveling across the Sea of Galilee because they had just heard word about all that they had done when Jesus had sent them out. So he'd sent out the 12 disciples earlier in the chapter, and they went out healing the sick and casting out demons and all this labor and all this work. No doubt they were tired. They come back, they report to Jesus what had taken place. And Jesus, understanding probably that they were tired from their ministry, decides that he's going to get away for a little while from the crowd. And so he decides to get into a boat. We'll see this from some of the other parallel passages from all the other Gospels. He gets into a boat and he decides to sail across the Sea of Galilee to get away from the crowd. But what happens in verse 10, it says, "And the apostle, when they had returned, told him all that they had done. Then he took them and went aside privately into a deserted place belonging to the city of Bethsaida. But when the multitude knew it," verse 11, "they followed him, and he received them and spoke to them." So apparently this crowd had gathered, and then he decides to leave with the disciples to get away from the crowd, goes to the other side, but they follow along. And so if you can imagine for a moment, they're in this boat, and Jesus is thinking, okay, we're going to get away, get to the other side, take a little ministry break here. And then he sees this whole crowd, 5, maybe 10,000 people, maybe even 20,000 people, following him on the other side along the coasts of the sea to where he can come. And so he gets off the boat, and they're waiting for him, pretty much. And they're wanting to have their lame healed and restored health to those who are sick and so forth. And so he does that in verse 11. And then in verse 12 it says, "When the day began to wear away, the 12 came and said to him, 'Send the multitude away that they may go into the surrounding towns and country and lodge and get provisions, for we are in a deserted place here.'" So in other words, they're saying, look, we have no food, and this place certainly does not provide for food, especially for this large number. We need to disperse the crowd so that they can go and get food for them. But interestingly, Jesus doesn't resort to that. In verse 13, he says, "But he said to them, 'You give them something to eat.'" Now, obviously, he's doing this to test them, to find out what they would do in response to his questioning to give them something to eat. Now, obviously, the disciples carried around a money purse, but it was certainly not significant enough to be able to produce the kind of resources necessary to buy food for 5,000 plus people in this deserted place. There wasn't enough food around. They went and they searched to find out how much food that they had, and they come up with about 5 loaves and a couple of fish. And certainly that is not sufficient enough. And so they're in a real dilemma. They don't know what to do. And so they respond here in verse 13, it says, "And they said, 'We have no more than 5 loaves and 2 fish, unless we go and buy food for all these people.' For there were about 5,000 men. Then he said to his disciples, 'Make them sit down in a group.'" So Jesus is going to come up with a solution here. And this crowd that had gathered, we're not sure. There were obviously some among the crowd that were there to have their sick healed, to have miracles being shown. There were some there maybe just out of curiosity, wanting to find out what he was doing. There were some who were followers of him and continued to be followers of him, even in the situations that were going to come with his persecutions and everything else. Some probably came because they wanted to make him king, and they wanted to be, you know, kind of in the court when the king ruled. But nevertheless, we know that it says that there were 5,000 with that was just counting the men. And so if you count the women and the children, all those that were gathered, maybe 10,000, maybe even 20,000. We're not sure. This is a huge, enormous amount of people. And can you imagine the cost that would be necessary to go and to buy the food for that many people? It must have been exorbitant. Now, in the other Gospels, we know that they counted up all the coins that they had, and it wasn't sufficient. And they said how much short they would have had in order to provide for the food. So Jesus in verse 13 challenges them. He says, "You give them something to eat." Jesus was testing them. And then they respond by basically saying, "We don't have nearly enough." And unfortunately, I think that we're often like these disciples, and that we don't really want to be bothered by the crowd. I think it's interesting that Jesus wanted to have them fed. But what did the disciples want to do? They wanted to send them away. Let them go fend for themselves. And Jesus said, no, no, you provide for them. And so here we have this this real situation that is upon them because of the challenge here. And then in verse 15, what we find is that Jesus has them sit down in crowds. They sit down in verse 16. Then he took the loaves, the two fish, looking up into heaven, he blessed and broke them, gave them to his disciples to set before the multitude. So they all ate and were filled, and 12 baskets of leftover fragments were taken up by them. And so this is just an incredible miracle. A miracle of multiplying food. Now we know that Jesus is indeed the creator of the universe. He is the one who brought all things into existence from nothing. So it's not a small thing for him to be able to just take some loaves and multiply those loaves and make them continue to extend beyond what they were supposed to do. But I think it's interesting to note that the disciples continue to look at the natural means. They looked at what they had available. They had a couple of fish and some loaves, and that wasn't sufficient. They looked at their money. That wasn't sufficient. But Jesus never once had the idea of the physical, did he? He always was focused on the spiritual and something that was supernatural in order to provide for them. I think it's interesting to note that Jesus very often likes to wait to the very last minute to do a miracle so that it shows that it's him that's doing it. We look at this throughout history. You remember back in the time of Moses when Moses had led the people of Egypt or people of Israel out of Egypt after the 10 plagues, and then they wander and they get to the Red Sea. And the Red Sea is before them, and then they look over the hill, and coming in the distance is what? The Egyptian army, led by Pharaoh. And they get to the point where it's almost too late, to where the Egyptians are almost in there, and they start crying out to Moses. Moses, why did you bring us out here in the wilderness to die? Here we are at the edge of the Red Sea. We have nowhere to go. And then what happens? Jesus shows up in a pillar of fire, doesn't he? And so we see this occurring over and over again. I think of the situation with Lazarus. Remember the situation with Lazarus? Lazarus dies. Good friend Lazarus, Jesus. And it's come and told to Jesus that his friend Lazarus is dying. And he waits 4 days till he's good and dead. I mean, I don't know how you can get good and dead and dead, but he's good and dead. I mean, he's starting to stink, the scriptures say, so good and dead. And so Jesus then goes, and when they get there, I don't know whether it was Martha or Mary, one of them says, if you had been here, he wouldn't have died. Right? And then Jesus raises him to life. Well, why did he wait? So that a greater miracle could occur. So that it would be definitely evident that it was Jesus who was involved. Remember the storm on the sea? When they were in the storm and Jesus was sleeping in the bow? And the storm gets worse and worse and worse, and they're up there trying to bail out the boat that's sinking. And finally they call out to Jesus, why are you sleeping? Don't you understand that we're dying? Why? You know, he knew the storm was coming. Why didn't he get up earlier and calm the storm? Because he wanted to wait till man had no more solutions. That's the way Jesus works. So often he waits till there's no more solution. And here we find the same thing. It had gotten late in the day. Well, why didn't he address this question earlier in the morning? Why didn't he look to the disciples and say, hey, look, this crowd's following us. We've got to make some kind of provision. While they're coming across here, why don't you go across and get some food for them? So that when evening time comes, they can have a meal. He didn't, though, did he? He waited till there was no more solution for man. He waited till man was at its rope before he was able to help them out. And so we see this occurring here in this case as well. You know, this happens with our salvation too, doesn't it? I think oftentimes it takes us to get to rock bottom. It takes us to get to the point where we realize we can't do it. The point to we realize it's not in our strength. It's not in our ability. It's not anything that we can do. Then we finally look to the Lord. And that's what the disciples did here. They came back and they said, there's not enough to feed him. So Jesus comes up with a solution. He organizes the crowd, verses 14 and 15. There's probably no real significance to the way in which he organizes them, but he certainly organizes them. We'll look at that a little bit more deeply here shortly. And then he multiplies the bread and the fish, demonstrates his power over creation, and then the crowd was filled. I think this is significant because I don't think that the real emphasis should be so much on what it was that fed them, or even on the multiplying the bread as much as it was the spiritual significance of him being able to do what he did. So what can we learn from these things by way of application or by way of implication and by way of principle? Well, one thing is that Jesus models for us compassion and hospitality. He models for us compassion and hospitality. As I mentioned earlier, you can see from the contrast between the way that Jesus responded to the need of the crowd and the way that the disciples responded to the need of the crowd that there was a real difference. Jesus, in responding to the crowd, he said, "No, you feed them." But what did the disciples say? "Send them away." And I think so often we're like that. We don't want to deal with the problems of people, and so we want them to be sent away. Let them deal with their own problems rather than allowing compassion to rule and to reign. Jesus on many occasions showed compassion. In another situation in Matthew chapter 15 where he feeds the 4,000, it says this, "Now Jesus called his disciples to himself and he said, 'I have compassion on the multitude because they have now continued with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. And I do not want to send them away hungry lest they faint on the way.'" Mark chapter 8 says something similar about a similar situation. And in Matthew chapter 9, verse 36, continuing on even with this passage, it says, "But when he saw the multitude, he was moved with compassion for them because they were weary and scattered like sheep, having no shepherd." And then also in Matthew chapter 14, the parallel passage to this one, where he speaks about the feeding of the 5,000, it says that he was moved with compassion for the crowd. You see, when we see others in need, that should be our response. We should be moved with compassion towards them. But I think so often we have hearts like the disciples and say, "Well, send them away so that they can figure it out for themselves," instead of extending our own hand and extending our own resources so that they might be able to have the help that they need when they need it. The second thing that we see here is that orderliness is of the Lord. Orderliness is of the Lord. I think it's interesting in verses 14 and 15 how he goes about actually distributing the food to the people. He has them all sit down in groups of 50, and so there's 100 groups of 50 or so. And we probably are looking at a rough estimate of the amount of people. He probably didn't actually go through and count them, but he goes through and tells them to all sit down in groups of 50. There was great order in the way in which he did things, because God is a God of order. Listen to what it says in Romans chapter 13, verse 13. It says, "Let us walk properly as in the day." You know what the word properly means? Orderly. Let's walk orderly, rightly. 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 40 says, "Let all things be done decently and in order." 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 12 says, "That you may walk properly toward those who are outside." And Titus chapter 1, verse 5, "For this reason I left you in Crete, that you should set in order the things that are lacking." In other words, over and over again in the scriptures, we see this idea of having things in order. Why? Because it reflects the orderliness of God. If you look in creation, you look in the natural world system that we live in, not the devilish system, but I'm talking about the creation, the nature. You go into the woods, so to speak, and you see the orderliness that is there. We see how things are in cycles and are in seasons, and we see how things reproduce each year, and new things come up from the trees before, and it just happens in patterns and cycles. That's the orderliness that God has created. Why? Because God is God of order. And so it's only reasonable that when he does something, he does things with orderliness. So this brings up a question. Is your life ruled by chaos or orderliness? I think sometimes if we look at our houses, or we look into our cars, or we look into our lives, or our calendars, or some other aspect of our life, we will see that very often our life is not characterized by order, but by chaos. And it shouldn't be. Now, I understand that there are some people who are just more naturally inclined towards order than others. And usually the more creative types are a little bit more free and not so much ordered. And those who are more analytical and engineering minded, they're usually more ordered and everything. But that doesn't mean that we should neglect order. We should all be involved in order because it reflects the orderliness of God. And then the third thing that we see here is that Jesus is the bread of life. Jesus is the bread of life. I think that the physical manifestation of the multiplying of the bread really demonstrates the spiritual reality that he is the bread of life in a spiritual sense. John chapter 6, verse 35 and 48 says, "And Jesus said to them, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst. I am the bread of life." John chapter 6, verse 33 and verse 51 says, "For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I shall give is my flesh, which I shall give for the life of the world." So what does it mean that he is the bread of life? What does it mean that he can multiply this bread and make it exceedingly abundant? And what does it mean that he is the bread that came down from heaven? Well, one thing is that it means that through him we have life. In him we have life. He is indeed life. For centuries now, many cultures have lived on bread. It's called the staff of life. Now, in today's world, there's a lot of criticism on bread. There's all kinds of Atkins diets and paleo diets and all these different kinds of diets that are trying to do away with grains and do away with breads and things like that. And I don't know where you stand on any of those, but for centuries, cultures have lived on bread. It has been the staff of life. And so it's not surprising that he would use the imagery of bread to explain the reality and the importance of him in the sense of life. It also means that he is better than the Moses of the Old Covenant. Moses provided manna in the wilderness. Jesus provided bread and fish in the wilderness. There is obviously a parallel between the two, and there is indeed a comparison as well, a contrast. Acts chapter 3, verse 22 says, "For Moses truly said to the fathers, 'The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren. Him you shall hear in all things, whatever he says to you.'" And as such, Jesus is the leader of the new covenant, the better covenant, the covenant that brings life. You know, we eat a lot in our household. As I mentioned already that, my kids now, are especially Samuel. Graham's always been a big eater. Samuel's now picking up steam. Abram's always been a pretty good eater. And Timothy recently has come on track. And so, it used to be that Joanna would fix this really huge meal, and there'd be lots of leftovers. Now, she fixes this huge meal, and the kids get done, they say, "Is this it? Isn't there any more?" Rarely do we have leftovers. I mean, it's crazy. And so, it's satisfying to know that Jesus, when he provides for his people, he provides in abundance, and it's good. The bread of life, he fulfills us with his word. It reminds me of the hymn that Graham and I are trying to memorize right now, and it's a challenge. I think he's almost got it down. I'm still lagging behind. But it's "Break Thou the Bread of Life." It's hymn number 263. Listen to these words. "Break Thou the Bread of Life, dear Lord, to me, as Thou didst break the loaves beside the sea." What's he talking about there? He's talking about this event right here, isn't he? "Beyond the sacred page I seek Thee, Lord. My spirit pants for Thee, O living Word. Bless Thou the truth, dear Lord, to me, as Thou didst bless the bread by Galilee. Then shall all bondage cease, all fetters fall, and I shall find my peace, my all in all." You see, Jesus is the bread of life. He is the one who gives us life. He is the one who sustains life. And so it's not surprising that he can provide the staff of life in abundance. And then fourthly, we learn from this passage that Jesus takes what we offer and multiplies it exceedingly. He takes what we offer and multiplies it exceedingly. You know, he only had a boy's lunch to work with. 5 loaves and a couple of fish. And by that, he was able to multiply that to be able to feed a whole crowd of 5 or 10,000, maybe even more people. So what can he do with what you offer him? You know, Romans chapter 12, verses 1 says, "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service." In other words, we are to offer our lives to him out of gratitude for what he has done to us. We are to say, "Lord, I'm in your hands. Do with me as you will." And you know what he does when we do that? He multiplies whatever we offer to him. He does it exceedingly. He takes our feeble prayers and makes them sweet-smelling incense before the Lord. Sometimes, you know, when I pray, when I hear others pray, I just think to myself, that doesn't do justice. But by the time it gets to the Lord, It's a perfected prayer because it goes through the blood of Christ. He takes our feeble prayers and makes them sweet-smelling incense before the Lord. He takes our pitiful attempts at doing good and he washes them in his blood. He takes a few dollars that we give to mission and multiplies them exceedingly so that the work is accomplished. He takes our feeble efforts to evangelize and adds to it his word and his spirit, and the result is radically changed lives. And if God can multiply a lunch so that it feeds 5,000, think what he can do with a life yielded to him. Be assured that if you are suffering and if you're offering yourself to the Lord, he will bring abundance from it. And then fifthly, Jesus will not neglect sacrificial followers of him. Jesus will not neglect sacrificial followers of him. The crowd had been hearing him preach and following him, and he was not about to let them go hungry. He was not about the God who was able to do miracles, the one who was able to raise the dead, the one who was able to heal the sick. He wasn't about to say, okay, well, yeah, sorry, you got to go hungry tonight. He wasn't about to do that. He does not neglect those who are following him. Matthew chapter 6, verse 25 and 26 says, therefore I say to you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food and your body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air, for they neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? He's not going to neglect his followers. Psalm 147 verse 9 says, he gives to the beast his food and to the young ravens that cry. Luke 12 verse 24, consider the ravens, for they neither sow nor reap, neither they gather into storehouses nor barn, and God feeds them. Aren't you of more value than they? Do not think that you can outgive God. He will not forsake those who give all to the Lord. We can read about missionaries who gave up so much so that they might go overseas. And in going overseas, they were blessed abundantly in the work that they were able to see done while they were there. That's the way God works. We offer a little bit. He multiplies it abundantly. We offer a little bit. He doesn't neglect us. And when we offer everything, he provides for us. He does not neglect us. And then sixthly, the provision of the Lord is enough and then some. The provision of the Lord is enough and then some. Luke chapter 9, verse 17, it says this. So they ate and were filled, and 12 baskets of leftover fragments were taken up by them. Everyone had enough, and there was still enough left over for the disciples for the next day. I think that's why they had 12 baskets. Each of the disciples had a basket. Here the disciples earlier were saying, we don't have enough food. We don't have enough money. Poor us. When all the while they knew Jesus was right there. And yet, when it was all said and done, they not only had enough to feed the crowd, they had enough for the next day as well because of the provision that Jesus made. When God provides, he doesn't do so barely, but he does so in abundance. Of course, he never wastes anything, but certainly he can provide for abundance, not just the bare minimum. Listen to what it says in 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 8. I love this verse, and I'm going to emphasize all the ways in which this verse speaks to abundance. And God is able to make all grace abound towards you, that always, having all sufficiency in all things, may have an abundance for every good work. Did you catch that? You see, our God is a God who doesn't just get by. He doesn't provide just enough. He provides enough and then some. We do not need to seek more than what God wants for us. When we seek the world, it always comes with a heartache. But when we are satisfied with what God provides, it is blessing enough. So what about you? Will you ask the Lord to provide you with a heart of compassion like his? Will you reflect the orderliness in your life that Jesus demonstrated in his? Will you trust Jesus as the author and leader of the new covenant, who is not just a provider of bread, but the bread of life himself? Will you give to Jesus what meagerliness you can, knowing that God can do great things with it? Will you trust God not to leave you without provision? And will you be satisfied with the provision of the Lord, knowing that he is able to provide for us not just a little, but a lot? Let us pray.
Now our country is lost, and it's not without cost, for there's many who struggle every day. And I think that it's time We start crying for our nation and bow our heads and pray. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? Just like the plant that withers away, we will leave many seeds behind. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? What will you do to change your legacy?